Kathy mentioned, I am not Keisha. I apologize for that. I could never be Keisha, but I will do my best today. So as was already said, my name is Amber Lenhart, and I am an associate with the Health Impact Project. And because I am a fill-in for this presentation, I hope you'll forgive me if I refer to my notes while I'm presenting. Before I move on, I want to say that I have no relationships, and neither does Keisha, to disclose. And the Health Impact Project is a collaboration of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Pew Charitable Trust, and we're based in Washington, D.C. And to date, we have invested over $20 million in advancing the field of health impact assessment, funded over 100 assessments, and supported training for more than 1,300 individuals, and served as a convener for practitioners in the field at the National Health Impact Assessment Meeting in D.C. So for this presentation, I'm going to provide a brief description and overview of HIA and the field nationally, and then I will go through a case example to demonstrate how HIAs, or health impact assessments, can impact the decision-making process, inequities, and social determinants of health. This is a... Oh, can you hear me back there? Am I loud enough? Thumbs up. Cool. Thank you. So just this is probably a familiar concept, but to just set some context, the gist of this chart is that we are spending a lot of money on healthcare, but not realizing the benefits of that expense in terms of our life expectancy. And part of the issue is that healthcare isn't the whole answer. Factors like where we live, where we work, our educational attainment, our economic situations all have impacts on our health. So health impact assessment is an approach that looks at how a proposed policy, plan, or program might impact those determinants of health, things like our education, our nutrition, noise and safety, for example, and how those impacts on health determinants could potentially lead to impacts on health outcomes. And HIA does take a pretty broad look at or definition of health. We define it as a state of well-being more than just a lack of disease or illness. This definition of health impact assessment comes from the National Research Council, which developed guidance for HIAs in 2010. I'm not going to read the whole definition, but I will highlight some key points. HIA is a structured process, not just a study. It's defined by six steps, which I'll go into more detail about later. The assessment of impacts may take quantitative data, gray literature, stakeholder input, and expert judgment into consideration in order to get an idea of the possible health outcomes and of that proposed decision or project. HIA translates science and community voice into recommendations for balanced, well-informed policies and offers feasible recommendations to help minimize potential negative health outcomes of a decision and maximize benefits. HIA also helps impacted populations and decision makers weigh trade-offs and understand the direct and indirect health impacts of their work. HIA also increases community capacity and awareness of HIA and of health, and can help build community capacity. HIA can be applied to a range of sectors, as you can see here. Most have traditionally been done in transportation and the built environment, but we're seeing more HIAs come out of other sectors like natural resources and energy. So HIA could inform, for example, decisions about mining or power plants. We see HIAs done in agriculture, food and drug decisions, housing, like the example that I'll walk through in a bit, education, like full-day kindergarten legislation, or safe routes to school, or truancy policies, economic policy and labor employment, so things like living wage ordinances or sick day leave, and then many others as well. HIAs are also done by a variety of types of practitioners. Most have been done by government agencies, so health departments, planning departments, but we also have seen HIAs done by nonprofits, educational institutions, tribal organizations, and others. And the field is really growing. Back when the Health Impact Project began in 2009, there were only 62 health impact assessments that we knew of that were in progress or completed. And today there are well over 345, and this slide really becomes outdated about the day after you put it together. So I mentioned that there are six steps in HIA. I'm going to describe each of those six steps really briefly before I walk through this example, and so you can keep them in mind when I'm talking through the example. The first step of HIA is screening. And in screening, we decide whether or not an HIA seems appropriate, if there's a decision out there that seems ripe for HIA. And not every decision is perfect for a health impact assessment, so the screening step really is important. In scoping, you start to think about the potential health pathways or health determinants that you'll consider, and the types of populations that might be impacted by the decision. And a point that I didn't make earlier is that health impact assessment considers health equity, not just health outcomes. So in thinking about those populations who might be impacted, health impact assessment also considers how vulnerable populations or different populations within a community might be differently impacted. And then in assessment, we use tools like literature review, primary and secondary data collection and analysis, modeling, focus groups, working with communities, bringing in expert voices from various fields or communities to help us get an idea of what the potential health impacts might be, both positive and negative, and start to think about how we could characterize those impacts, so how large they will be, who will be affected, how serious they will be. And then practitioners develop recommendations based on the findings of their assessment with the goal of maximizing the potential beneficial health outcomes and minimizing any risks. The reporting phase, HIA usually culminates in a final report, but in reporting that could take on different approaches depending on your audience. So you might have policymaker briefs or community-specific outreach efforts. And then in monitoring and evaluation, we have an opportunity to look back at the HIA process and say, how well did it fit with the guidance that's out there for the field? And also to answer the question, what outcome did the HIA have? What impacts did it have? Did it actually impact the decision-making process, which is really the goal of HIA? Did it impact health outcomes? So now I'm going to walk through an example of a health impact assessment that was done by my colleagues at the Health Impact Project, Ruth Lindberg and Keisha Pollock. They did this in collaboration with the Oregon Public Health Institute and the Metropolitan Area Planning Council, two organizations that are recognized for their HIA expertise in the U.S. And for those who may not be familiar with the designated housing rule, like myself, it gives public housing authorities the option to designate certain public housing properties or parts of those properties for seniors, senior families, or disabled families, or a mix of those two. And I'll provide a bit more detail on the rule in this next slide here. The designated housing rule is one of many tools used by public housing authorities to allocate scarce resources and provide housing for seniors and people with disabilities who live in their jurisdictions. Designated housing units make up less than 6% of public housing nationwide. There are approximately 63,000 designated units, and from the maps you can see that the majority, actually 91%, are designated for senior families as opposed to disabled families. Designated units are predominantly located on the East Coast and in the Midwest and in the metropolitan areas of those regions, so it's not a surprise that the public housing authorities that use this rule tend to be larger and located in metropolitan areas. We talked about screening as being the first step of HIA. This particular HIA arose from a screening workshop that my colleagues conducted with members of the National Prevention Council a few years ago. Following this screening workshop, HUD expressed interest in applying HIA to their designated housing rulemaking process. So the main goal of the assessment was to inform the decision-making process of HUD about this rulemaking, but it was also intended to demonstrate how HIA might be used in the context of a federal rulemaking process as a tool to advance the National Prevention Council's goals as well. The Public Housing Program is one of several federal programs that aim to improve access to affordable housing and improve housing conditions for low-income families. Over half of the households that live in public housing are headed by senior families or younger disabled families. One thing I want to note here is I'm talking about senior families and disabled families like they're two very distinct populations, but when my colleagues were doing this health impact assessment, they made an effort to acknowledge the ways that these two populations overlap and highlight the opportunities to support health in both populations. So for example, a lot of seniors also have a disability, or a lot of young people with a disability will eventually age and become seniors themselves.
Some more chairs down here. There's two in the front row. There's another one here. Raise your hand if you've got a chair next to you, just so we can help move people in to get comfortable.
Great crowd. Take your seats, I'll just keep talking. So in order to inform HUD's development of the updated rule, my colleagues completed the assessment before the rulemaking process began. And the HI examined two scenarios that HUD could pursue in its rulemaking, developed in consultation with key stakeholders. A number of methods were used in the assessment, including an extensive literature review, quantitative data analysis of national housing and health data sets, and qualitative research with housing authority staff, community partners, and residents. And my colleagues worked with three case study sites throughout the HIA, the Housing Authority of the City of Milwaukee, Denver Housing Authority, and Cambridge Housing Authority in Massachusetts. And to support the goal of testing the use of HIA in the context of a federal rulemaking process, my colleagues made a conscious effort to draw from data sources, methods, and stakeholder input processes that HUD could replicate and scale to fit the scope, resources, and timeline of future agency efforts to incorporate health considerations into their future decision making. They are also guided throughout this HIA by an 11-member advisory committee with diverse expertise in housing policy, fair housing, homelessness, housing administration, and issues that may affect older adults or people with disabilities. The HIA focused on six factors to health that could be affected by designated housing rulemaking. I mentioned the scoping step, so that's where you think about the different pathways that you're going to consider in your HIA. And what they found to be the important factors that might be impacted by the rulemaking were the availability and affordability of housing, housing discrimination and the ability of people to choose the type of housing or the neighborhoods where they will live, connections, relationships, and interaction between residents, so social capital and social cohesion, and the possible coordination with services like transportation to medical appointments or availability of substance abuse programs, among other things, the design, safety, and accessibility of housing units, and neighborhood characteristics such as availability of public transportation and grocery stores, levels of racial and economic segregation, crime and perceived safety. And I don't have time to talk through the range of findings today, but I did bring a number of issue briefs, and I encourage you to swing by and pick one up if you're interested. And I'll also show you a link where you can get the whole report if you're interested. After they did their assessment and then crafted a number of recommendations for ways that HUD could protect and promote health in its rulemaking, including by expanding partnerships that help bring together affordable housing and supportive services, making sure that designated housing plans are consistent with local fair housing efforts, strengthening data availability and accuracy to provide a more accurate estimate of affordable housing needs, so current data sources don't capture people who are either homeless or living in institutions, such as nursing homes or assisted living facilities, who might want to transition back into integrated community living. And the last recommendation was to provide guidance to housing authorities on how to incorporate neighborhood metrics into their designated housing plans. So I know that was a really quick overview of that health impact assessment. It's a great report. I do recommend checking it out if that sounded at all interesting to you. Again, please come grab a brief if you're interested, and then you can also access the full report on our website. The link is here, but you can also just Google it or grab a brief and take a picture of the brief and use that. So I just want to say thank you again so much for your time today. I will do my best to answer any questions that you have. I think at the end of the session is when we're going to do questions. If your questions are specific to that HIA that I talked about, I will probably have to tell you to look at the report and contact my colleague Ruth Lindberg, but I will do my best to answer your questions.
Okay, thank you, Amber. There's still another seat in the front row here, and I guess they've got issues about being near the door. There's a couple more. Raise your hand for the people in the back if they want to come in, because I guess we've got a standing room only, but we still have a few open chairs, so it's not quite standing room only. So don't be shy. So now it's actually my great pleasure to introduce the going out president of ASTO, but she's still, Dr. Jewel Mullen, is still the Connecticut Department for Public Health Commissioner, and she's been there almost 5 years. And she loves her job, but she also finds joy playing tennis or working in her gardens. And she helps these, and she hopes that these activities will actually support what she hopes is a sign of longevity. Her grandmother is 108 years old. And her name is Beatrice, so I'm just like really blown away by that. So without further ado,
can you tell we like each other up here? So good morning, everyone. I appreciate having the opportunity to talk to you about the work I've done over my past year as the ASCO president. And I have a million slides, and I'm not going to talk about most of them because I figure in your leisure you might be able to look at them. And I decided this morning that for this session, telling you for a couple of minutes about where I grew up might be more relevant than what's on a lot of my slides. So I grew up in City Park. City Park is a public housing project in lovely New Rochelle, New York. That's where the Petries, Rob and Laura, Dick Van Dyke were. And I have to say that when we moved in there in the 50s, and we stayed there until the 70s, it was low to moderate income housing. And, you know, if you needed to live in a housing project, that was probably the best place to be, in a lovely community with great public schools and a lot of the other assets that families need to thrive. But City Park was unique, and I think helped frame my perspective about what older adults also deserve throughout the life course, because it was intergenerational housing, which had been built right after World War II, in which many of the apartments were designed to accommodate people who were amputees and had other disabilities. And so we grew up with all the generations right around us. And even though there was, say, no designated parking, people knew, well, that's where Miss Dooley parks. She needs to be closer to the building. And nobody else parked there. There were social rooms where people could do intergenerational activities. Older adults played with younger adults. People watched out for each other. Our community was resilient. So during storms or power outages, people knew who to check on without needing a registry or a database or anything else to figure out who to go and look for. The public transportation, we had a bus stop right at the end of the parking lot so people could get to other parts of New Rochelle. And the bookmobile came so that not only could kids go and we could all get our weekly books, but that was another asset that was available to everyone. So we had a lot of what doesn't exist in a lot of communities today. Even the two stores that we could walk to for food had fresh produce and reasonable meat, and beer and cigarettes and the things that even then kids could buy because we didn't have the laws in place that we have right now. So just think about that and what it means to grow up observing that that's what a health-promoting community looks like, and consider how that doesn't really exist in a lot of housing projects or cul-de-sacs in the United States anymore. And then I think we even understand even better why this session is so important.